You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. You may have first heard Giuliovi's name in 2006 when she originated the Homicide Report. Any of you familiar with the Homicide Report? Yes, many of you here. Quite an amazing thing, which was a blog for the Los Angeles Times in which she attempted to cover every murder in Los Angeles County in a single year. It was a radical idea and a nearly impossible task. And in a 2008 article, she acknowledged that the report, quote, has merely skimmed a problem whose true depths couldn't be conveyed. Her new book, Ghettocide, is packed with hard-won insights, and it takes us into the depths of that problem, our nation's homicide problem, our city's problem, our community's problem. The book serves, as the review in the New York Times pointed out, as, quote, a crucial 366-page reminder that Black Lives Matter, showing how the system's failure to catch killers effectively made Black lives cheap. In her book, you'll meet some memorable characters, including a remarkable homicide detective, John Skaggs, who wins the trust of the community for his compassionate and relentless pursuit of justice for the families of homicide victims. Skaggs treats every homicide case, quote, like the hottest celebrity crime in town. You'll meet the father and mother of homicide victims, most memorably the parents of Bryant Tonelli, who was just 18 years old when he walked down a street not far from his house, carrying a root beer and pushing a bicycle, when a stranger jumped out of a car, shot him, and escaped. I actually could not put this book down, and even though the facts are heart-wrenching, Liovi's writing is propulsive, it's crackling, and you want to know what happens, how will the interrogation unfold, will the witnesses testify, and will there actually be a conviction? Her book presents a nuanced portrait of the LAPD and shows divisions even within the force. You'll learn that, like elementary school teachers, homicide detectives have to purchase their own supplies, which is quite amazing, even those blue binders that they keep their cases in. On Fresh Air the other night, I heard Liovi describe the mission of her book as this, and I quickly pulled out my pen and wrote it down. I thought it was such a great sentence. Vigor marshaled against what matters, against violence. And think about that. That's what she said is the mission of this book, and her masterful book is a great contribution to that cause. Giuliovi has been a reporter and editor at the Los Angeles Times for 15 years. She's the recipient of numerous journalism awards, including as a member of a six-reporter team, the 1998 Pulitzer Prize for Breaking News. And in conversation with Jill tonight, we're delighted to have one great reporter interview another as we welcome Warren Olney back to Aloud. Warren is the host and executive producer of To the Point and Which Way LA, the signature daily local news program on 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. His programs have been honored with numerous awards. I won't even attempt to list them. He's also had a long and lauded career as a television news reporter and anchor, and his special projects and investigations have focused on crime, science, and the environment, among other issues. Please welcome Giuliovi and Warren Olney. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a real privilege for me to appear with Jill Liovi. I think Louise did a wonderful job of describing the book in general terms. It's a wonderful read. It's full of tragedy. It's full of horror. But you read on because it is so gracefully written. It is so deeply researched. And because it has what I can only describe as a sort of rage to understand why it is that the things that she has encountered and that she describes are going on. It's a very impressive work, and Jill, it's a privilege for me once again to be here with you. Louise mentioned that this came out of the project where you reported on every murder that had occurred in Los Angeles County over the period of a year. You embedded at the 77th Division of the LAPD as part of, or that was part of your effort. Begin by telling us what that was like, and what your life was like when you were embedded.
Well, I had several phases of it. I was first embedded in 77th Division, actually back in 2002, and then later in Watts, which was one of the advantages I had in writing this book, because the characters, I ended up knowing them really over the course of 10 years and seeing them develop in their professions. When I first went to 77th, I actually didn't mingle a lot with the officers. They gave me a desk in the squad room, but it was off to the side, and it took quite a while before people would talk to me. But by the end, by the time that I was doing my last embed in criminal gang homicide, I was among people who I'd known for a number of years at that point and had seen on a regular basis for years, and it really was like going into a familiar workplace every day, except for I wasn't doing any of the real work, of course. So,
but you also had contact with people in the neighborhood who were being policed, if you will. You must not have been able to have policemen at your side when you were engaged with the people in the community. How did you manage to maintain the distinction so that you could still be trusted?
I really had to do those two portions of the book separately, except for in a few cases where, you know, I knew people while they were dealing with police, and I also knew them outside the police presence. But mostly, I had to really separate that work and separate it physically in space and time. If I was shadowing the police officers and seeing with them and going places with them, I was, you know, it prevented me from being able to go back later and really talk to people very easily. I did do that to some degree. But a lot of the information about the streets in the book was just had to be done completely on my own in a different time period, sometimes in different spaces, so that I wasn't associated with the police. And in fact, the very, very few dicey moments I ever had doing this work was when I was mistaken for a police officer, a plainclothes detective, just working, which was a silly mistake because they usually don't work alone. But it happened to me maybe twice where people thought I was a police officer.
What happened?
They were hostile.
But you were able, obviously, to overcome that.
Or sometimes you just leave.
You just depart the scene. When did you hear first the term that's the title of your book, Ghetto Side? And it seems to have more than one meaning.
You know, I didn't hear it a lot, and it's actually not a lot in use. I had heard it on the street. I had it in my notes for this book when one of the detectives in a sedan was talking about something that is often talked about, which is favorite terminology, because there's a vernacular in this world and in these neighborhoods that really is incredibly apt and lyrical, and even the cops themselves are susceptible to it and tend to like it and pick up these terms. And he was saying that this was a term that he'd heard and it was one of his favorite. And it has particular resonance in South LA because, you know, the real estate covenant line went down Main Street. And so in these neighborhoods, people still say East Side and West Side. They don't mean the East Side and West Side of Los Angeles. They mean East Side, West Side of Main Street, so that the point of saying Ghetto Side was East Side, West Side, it's all the same, it's Ghetto Side. And it was a term that sort of summed up how isolated this world seemed to be. And I quote one of the officers in the book talking about pulling off the freeway into another world, into another country, and that's a phrase I must have heard uttered by 30 cops. It really does feel like a different planet to them sometimes. I think.
You call it at one point a walled city.
That's right. That's right. And I use Albert Camus' The Plague, which is so apt because it's about an actual walled city, but he uses it metaphorically too, in the sense that you're just a little bit away and the death that's happening in there is very distant and very abstract and completely unintelligible. I think that the same thing was true in South LA, that people would have a hard time talking about it when they left their neighborhoods. I remember an officer I knew used to, he had an anecdote about a real estate agent in his neighborhood just on the other side of the line in Orange County, maybe not even too far south, who was surprised when he told him what his work was and said, "Are there still gangs in LA?" And it had so, I mean, it had deeply, deeply rocked him, that remark. And he told me that anecdote several times, and you could see in his eyes that it just ate him up, that he had to go out in the world after dealing with a place where at that time there were 30 shootings a month, and just 5 miles down the freeway, someone would say, "Are there still gangs there?" It's traumatizing, actually, in its own way.
As Louise pointed out, you draw characters. You're not drawing characters. You didn't make them up. But you describe characters, real human beings, in ways that really do make them very interesting and very individualized. You're looking for patterns, it seems to me, as you try to understand what's going on. But there are no stereotypes. In this book, everybody emerges as a person that is identifiable, and that's one of the things that makes it so interesting. You want to know what happens to those people and more about them. But you also are looking for patterns. Why don't you read a little bit from a part of the book? And I think the part you're going to read is the shadow?
Well, I was going to read a little bit from the history part, and that's
the history part. Okay,
that's to torture everybody a little. Of course, the book is, I think, one of my blurbs, and I like this one, called it, it's disguised as a detective story. Like I'm trying to pull something over on people, and I thought that that's actually about right, because what I'm interested in is the causes, and this section I'm about to read is not the most compelling part of the book, but boy, was it a lot of work, Warren. It was so much work, so I'm going to read this. From before emancipation, Southern law was infirm. Slave owners wanted the power to discipline slaves without legal constraints. After the Civil War and Reconstruction, ex-Confederates murdered their way to control again, terrorizing emancipated black people and their white supporters into submission. This set the stage for the racist atrocities of Southern law that are somewhat better known to Americans, the stacked courts, fee systems, chain gangs, abuses so systematic that across the South, people dismiss the whole framework as the white man's court. Those white conservatives favored legal systems that look the part but still achieved a racist intent, a winking system that by design just went through the motions. Southern legal institutions appeared to observe constitutional due process, but real power was held outside the law. Getting away with murder was key to the white supremacist project. Impunity is a stencil of law. It outlines a shadow system. Southern legal institutions were, by turns, hypocritical, corrupt, partisan, ineffective, infected with vigilantism or too feeble to combat it. In this way, the South cultivated the Furies in all their dark horror. Its harvest was factionalism, informal systems of discipline and self-policing, terrifying etiquette restrictions, witness intimidation, vigilantism, rumors, arson, lynching, and a homemade system of order based on relationships that historian Mark Schultz dubbed personalism, the whole dreary cornucopia of informal justice.
Now, that's good stuff. All right.
It's a lot of work.
You suggest that was transported to Los Angeles from the South in the late 40s? Or
what I would say is
during World War II?
Those same conditions were maintained. And it's an important difference. It's, as I say in the book, it's not just a bad habit. It's not just a cultural way of being that people held on to. When you have that much impunity and some of the abetting conditions, it's going to inevitably create that. It's almost a material state. And so many things obviously changed in that, you know, in the years after the Jim Crow system fell and through the civil rights movement. But as I say in that, my book, you know, that 35-45% solve rate for murders is really not that different than what it was in the Jim Crow South. So that aspect of things didn't change. And if you follow the line of reasoning that I cite Eric Monken and the great homicide historian at UCLA, the idea that, you know, that the default state is that we kill each other a lot. You do see that in the world. And that it takes a long time to build this elaborate legal apparatus that contains violence in a society and makes the price of murder too expensive, that it's a very long developmental process and an incremental process where people cede their power of violence to the state. There's just nowhere in the history of Black America where that could have happened. It wasn't going to happen in the South. It certainly wasn't going to happen in the industrial cities of the 40s and 50s. And as I go on in my book, it didn't happen in the high crime and high leniency era of the 60s and 70s, nor in the high crime and harsh justice era that followed it, like a ricochet in the 80s and 90s. So there's just no point along the way where you can have a robust development of a functioning legal system, given the infirmities that you began with.
I want to come back to some of these broad themes, but once again, as Louise mentioned, and as I said as well, some of the persons, the human beings that you describe, I don't want to even call them characters because it sounds once again like it's fiction. Of course, it's not, are really very vivid and interesting. She mentioned Bryant Tonelli. Tell us about Bryant Tonelli's father, Wally Tonelli.
Well, as one of his friends said, Wally Tonelli is very matter of fact. And it's interesting, having dealt with many, many families who have lost usually children to homicide, you see all kinds of different reactions. That very contained reaction that he had is rare in my experience, and it's actually, in some paradoxical way, it's more painful to deal with.
So first of all, he was the father,
of
a murder victim, the principal murder victim that you deal with, although you deal with others as well. Who was he? What did he do?
He's a detective with the LAPD. I say about Wally Tonelli that we will never again have detectives like this. These are people who got their training during the peak homicide years of the 80s and 90s, when we had more than 1,000 homicides per year in LA. They handled caseloads that are easily three or and even four times what caseloads are typically now, even the high divisions. They learned on the job, and they just knew more than anybody else. By the time of the events that I describe in the book, he has ascended through the department and is working at the elite RHD unit as a homicide detective. He had had one little fillip in his career where he actually asked for a demotion at one point to stay in homicide because it was the practice of the department to promote you into other functions. And he quickly realized that he was such a committed homicide investigator that he was willing to give up pay in order to remain in that job.
And he was the homicide detective who had to say at some point, "That's my son."
Yes, he lived close enough by. He had been contacted by a neighbor and came while the paramedics were still working on Bryant to the scene.
What
actually ended up testifying in court.
What's the significance of where he lived?
So Wally Tonelli is Black. He was from Alabama originally. I think he came as an elementary school child to L.A. with his family at a time when a lot of people were coming out of the South to L.A. He was rare in the sense that he had decided to live in the L.A. city limits and in 77th Division. And he had decided that for a lot of reasons. There were a lot of, he had grown up around that area. He had family around that area. The area is actually extremely nice. But he also, as he told me, maybe after six or seven times being asked in three different interviews, he lived there because he believed that that was the right thing for a police officer to do, to live in the community that they were policing.
Most police officers, or at least many police officers in the LAPD, don't. They live in Simi Valley, they live in Orange County.
It's hard to get numbers. I think I cited in my footnotes of the book that they put out a press release in the early 2000s that 23% of officers do live in the city. So some three quarters live outside the city. They do tend to collect in San Pedro and in the valley, although there are some around South LA, but certainly he was an outlier, and it was noticed by his colleagues.
I was going to say he got a lot of heat from his colleagues in the department, or at least he was criticized. They want to know, why would you want to live
right
there?
I don't think they said it to his face, but that's a typical attitude, and I think other officers who live in those divisions had experienced similar things.
So is there any policy effort being made at the department to try to encourage officers to live where they work?
No, I don't know that. I mean, there was, I think the press release I referenced, there have been, I think, mortgage programs and things to encourage home buying. It's not an easy thing, I think, actually, and it's something that is often misunderstood about policing. Policing is about conflict. It's about incredibly serious conflicts. So police officers are in terrible conflict with people all day long in their jobs, and it's a lot, I think, in some ways, to expect them to live around that conflict. And there, there are enough crimes against police officers that the DA's office has some unit devoted to that, I believe. So safety concerns are one of the reasons why police officers don't live in the city. And the other is that, I don't know what the starting pay was. I think in the years I was doing this, it was in the high 50s maybe for young officers, particularly if they have a family. The idea of buying a house out in Fontana or somewhere, you just get a lot better deal, and you can actually do it where no one else can because you're driving into work at 4 a.m. anyway, so you can actually do that freeway drive.
You mentioned that Wally Tonelli either resisted a promotion or asked for a demotion because he wanted to remain a detective. What about that? The idea that you would think being a detective is a pretty important aspect of police work, and yet the LAPD has a policy where it's sort of a low-level position, regardless of what you see on TV, regardless of what you would think ought to be the case. Is there a sort of misplaced priorities there?
Well, in LAPD has a very particular structure. I would say it's a middling position. There is a tendency to sort of move people from one detective table to another. I think it's, the book is written because I think it's misplaced priorities, but this is an important point, Warren. I mean, the police department, I think, and some of the things I suggest in the book are not something the police department can change. I talk in the book about how detectives really should be salaried. They should just do whatever they need to do for a case, and we shouldn't have to pay them overtime or have them stop working. They should just be considered professionals. Well, that's, In our current system, that's crazy talk. They have labor contracts. They can't change it. They have a bureaucracy that functions the way it does, in part because it's been responding to public preferences and input for all these years. I really think with the kinds of paradigm shifts that I'm talking about in the book, where high-quality policing, investigations sort of are elevated as a function, that it has to start from outside the police department. It has to start with public attitudes. It has to start with academic research and things like that. They can't invent new mandates for themselves or radically shake up the structure of the department. These things are...
Tell us about some of the other people that you encountered. For example, the mother of a murder victim who encouraged witnesses not to come forward and reveal what they had seen. Yeah,
and that was some of the more interesting interviews I had in the book, was that when the detectives are dealing with all of this reluctance of witnesses, they get blank faces, they get doors slammed, and to go back and then talk to those witnesses and say, well, why? What is your reason for not cooperating? There's all kinds of reasons that that the cops didn't know and that were very surprising. In this case, this was, she felt she was acting responsibly. She felt that she was acting selflessly, and it wasn't, her thinking on it, I don't think, was irrational. There had been a couple young men shot on the block besides her son. She knew that their parents were already terrified, and she felt bad. She said, I love my neighbors. I don't want to put them in this terrible position, and I don't want them to lose their sons, because I know how much this hurts. And so I'm not going to put any pressure on them. In fact, I'm going to tell them that they don't have to do this for me, because I understand the predicament they're in. And she was an act of generosity towards her neighbors.
Is the fact that it's so dangerous to be a witness illustrative of a kind of informal justice system? I hate to call it a justice system, but system of order maybe is a better term that you talk about, that exists because of the failure of the, what we call the justice system, to function in this area.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that. I think that there's a couple other conspiring factors that make this thing gel. It's not just high rates of impunity for violence, although that's extremely important. Hypersegregation is what the sociologists call it, the idea that people are very, very isolated and not too mobile in these neighborhoods. So they're in enclaves. They're on islands altogether. They're in that walled city. And, of course, talking about the 20th century, this is one that didn't change a lot, even after the Civil Rights Movement. The likelihood that a white person and a black person would live next to each other in the city of Los Angeles barely changed at all from the 1970s to 2000. So that extreme isolation of a neighborhood like Watts was maintained. And then the other one is the underground economy, the idea that everything is happening in a black market, everything's happening off the books. You put all those things together and you lower the price of violence. You make violence a kind of currency that works and is easy to use, and it does become currency, and it does have its own rules and its own order. And I think there is one of the more radical papers that I saw written by a sociologist did posit that actually you could conceivably there would be more violence without the gangs, which seems so crazy. And, you know, the first thing that should be said about the informal order is it's not a very good order. And so it's pretty ragged and there's a lot of violence. But it's not, conceptually, that's not an insane thought. You look at the housing projects, for instance. I was looking at shootings in the middle of the first decade of the 2000s around Nickerson Gardens and Imperial Courts. And what you see is that most of the shootings are at the edge of the housing projects, and there's not actually that many inside it, and the ones that there are tend to be gang infighting. Well, that's because it's claimed by a single gang, and they protect their sphere, and so it's the border areas that are fighting, and then if there are killings inside the projects, it's the gang fighting, infighting with itself. And I think the other place that you see this is in the intimidation and the message sending. There's so many things that go on that fall short of violence, that are simply trying to indicate, I might do something. That's why I'm driving my car slowly past your house. That's why I'm giving you a hard stare. That's why I sucked my tooth when I looked at you. It's all this message sending, which is very, very typical of these sort of informal justice situations, which what that is it's evoking a set of rules, right? It's saying, you know what I'm talking about. You know what it means when I give you a hard stare. You know it doesn't mean just a stare. It means this potential for violence, but I'm not going to cost myself that expense right now because I can do it at this even lower price. So everyone is working with the same currency.
So when you have a setup like that, what's the attitude, or how does that influence the attitude toward the police?
I mean, I think there's a range of attitudes, but one of the singular things is you see really paradoxical attitudes. You see people, it's kind of loving and hating the police in the same breath. I talk about the derogatory term one time, which kind of goes along with cracker and popo and other things that get hollered at the police. But one time is a traditional insult, and it means you only come around once a day, which really was the case, particularly with urban policing in the South. And as I say in the book, it sort of suggests that more times is actually what we want. And this has a long history. Gunnar Myrdal, who did an extensive study of Southern blacks in the 40s, talks about, and this is a time when, you know, the police are torturing people. They are rounding them up on vagrancy. There's a lot of corruption. They're this really oppressive force in the, you know, in the Jim Crow South in black people's lives. And yet he would interview people and they'd still say, well, we hate the police and they're terrible, but we want more of them. We still feel unprotected and we still want them to do their jobs more vigorously. It's the two things are actually not in conflict, but it's a subtlety that's been there for a long time in this relationship.
One of the things you refer to, and I think it's a chapter title, is the phrase, everybody knows.
Everybody knows. And in fact, there's a homicide that's not really mentioned much in the book, but that I was very interested, that comes up when I'm talking to one of the defendants at the very end of the book. And I had to ask him. I was like, who did this homicide? And he said that to me even, and he said, everyone knows who did the homicide. It's something that you hear all the time. It's that idea of, it tells you that they're instrumental crimes. And that's a term that social scientists have used, I think in too simple a way. Instrumental means it gets you something. Well, it's a robbery. Well, no, it gets you political power on the street, and it doesn't work. You don't have influence. You don't have the power to intimidate. You don't have the power of control or the power to just give you a hard stare and have you know what it means, unless everybody knows what you're capable of, unless people know that you're a shooter, that this is not a game. You have to have some degree of publicness about these crimes. And again, this is something that you see in other informal justice situations. And I think the most concrete example is putting up a sign, which is very common, is graffiti that says, I did this. And that's something that homicide detectives use a lot as clues. Well, think about that. Think about graffitiing some gloating remark about a killing you've just committed. This is not the kind of furtive killings that we think about Sherlock Holmes solving. It's a totally different kind of crime.
A lot of people who are outside the system, I would include myself as one, think that what we're seeing is mindless killing. But you're saying it's not mindless killing, that there are reasons for it.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. I think when I was in 77th and 2008, there was one killing. I won't describe the gruesome details, but it was a mayhem charge and a murder charge. Somebody who had just, he had, I think, maimed the victim. There was some sex offenses involved in this, and it was weird, and it was senseless, and it was crazy. And I remember when the detectives came back, all their colleagues gathered around to hear them talk about this case, shaking their heads, because even though they were handling dozens and dozens of murders a year, they'd never heard of one like this. They'd never heard of a weird one that made no sense at all, because most of the crimes they were investigating did have some rationale. This is a very, tricky and sad thing about homicide problems, because everywhere you go and everywhere in the world where you find high homicide rates, they look like a lot of really trivial motives. They look like petty argument homicides, and of course argument homicides have dominated forever, but it doesn't mean that the problem is actually petty. If the situation is, as the juror says at the end of my book, if you back down, you back down forever. In an environment where your extant risk of homicide is already, is already the same as a soldier in battle, that idea that just backing down over a small insult, upping the chance that you might get beat up or hurt later, is a powerful motive for standing up for yourself. It's not that you're just being prickly. It's not just that you're being irrational. You are making an economic choice about what you need to do to stay safe when you're just scared as you could be already. So there's one of the traditional societies that I looked at when I was trying to understand other homicide environments was what were then called Eskimos in the 1920s. And an anthropologist who studying them noted that they had these very high rates of homicide, which is not uncommon in a lot of these traditional societies, and that it always seemed to be insults. It always seemed to be very petty, some argument by the fire one night over some comment about somebody's mother. And then the anthropologist gave the example. He said, at the same time, you see them tolerating a lot of horror. And he gave the example of a member of this band whose brother had been killed by another member. And he said it was remarkable because they seemed to go on and get along fine for years after that. And, of course, this is a situation where they're totally dependent on each other, right? For years after, they would laugh and joke, and then one night by the fire, the killer made some off remark, and the brother was like, that's it, and killed him on the spot. Well, okay, petty, maybe, but that guy had been waiting for years, right, for that moment. And there's much more to it. In the same way, the pettiness is almost a sign of conflict being repressed and then coming out this way is the way I look at it. And it's such a common theme. If you go to, even if you go in the past, the one that I always marked, it was in almost every book I read about the history of homicide, the homicide of the party. For some reason, someone comes to a party, there's a fight at a party, they're not welcome at a party, they leave the party, they come back, or the guests of the party follow them, and they have a conflict. This is a homicide that happens all the time. I think I did a blog item on the homicide report halfway through the year that there had been 30 of them in LA that year. Well, that comes up in the Southern context. You see it in other countries. I found South African homicides. It's that same party homicide. The shape of them look very much the same, but I think that they point to deeper dynamics.
Let's talk a little bit more about the police and the detectives who have to try to solve these crimes. Is their primary job to find out what that reason is, what that logic was, if that's the right term, behind the killing? Is that what they have to do?
No, they have to find out who did it and then find enough corroborating evidence to convince a jury that they did it. And the motives often remain murky. You know, that's a common thing. They do go to motive. This has been an important thing that's happened in the criminal justice system in California is gang enhancement. And so gang enhancement becomes an issue at trial, and to prove that there were gang motives, I actually think that can kind of contort things more than clarify them sometimes. But it's often mysterious, but you often do find that there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more to it, that the person who was killed over an insult was also a person who had beaten up somebody who was very loved by somebody else a few weeks earlier or something like that. That's a common thing.
Tell us about Detective Skaggs, who is such an important figure in your book, from the way he looks to the way he thinks to the way he acts.
Well, he was such a great vehicle for what I was trying to say in the book, which is talking about that idea of vigor, because that was kind of a credo in his life, is to be very, very energetic and to the getting up early in the morning always sort of amused me, because he would talk as if everybody was like that. And he would mention somebody to me, so-and-so doesn't come into work till 6:30, and I was supposed to be very outraged by this. He'd be very kind of not seeing that all weren't like that. He really, I think it was not just him. It was his supervisor in Southeast and kind of the standards they set in that unit. But they really had this idea that you work all the time, you work all day long, that you're very, very aggressive. And it's so much about the environment. His way of working tells you a lot about the homicide problem. His idea was that you just talk to people, you get out there, you see them face to face, you don't make appointments, you don't make phone calls, you confront, and if they don't talk to you, you go back again and again and again, and you just hammer it. Well, that says a lot about this environment where everybody knows, where people are sort of on the fence about whether to trust the justice system or not. The reason his methods were effective is because the nature of the homicide problem is what it is. But the focus on personal appearance, I thought, was very interesting. It was true of everyone in that unit, but they really wanted to look, like they were important, and like the job was as important as any corporate law job, that this was a very, very serious thing, and to communicate to people the somberness of it, the veneration that they should have for the justice system everywhere they went, in an environment where it's kind of hard to stay, clean and crisp sometimes.
There are different ways, though, for detectives to operate, and Skaggs at one point has a partner who operates in a very different way from him, who's not necessarily ineffective, but he just has a different style. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and then his partner, Chris Barling, they were very, very odd pairing, opposites, but that's often true of detectives. I think that one of the things, it's actually something that reporters learn too, is that eventually you learn you're most effective when you're most yourself, when you're presenting yourself very truthfully, you make the most advances, and so they tend to be real. The successful ones tend to be real personalities, tend to be really fully. I would say easy to caricature, which kind of made it good for me. But so his partner was very talkative, very kind of, if I may say, a bit of a bleeding heart. Something that Skaggs was not at all, you would not hear him talking in a sentimental way at all about his job. But somehow that was a healthy thing for both of them, I think.
How do they feel when it's said that what they're really doing is going through the motions and essentially with the conviction rate being what it is, very low, and just being part of an organization that's protecting the white community that surrounds the walled city rather than administering justice within the walled city itself?
It's extremely frustrating, and there's a detective who actually quits in the book because he becomes so frustrated. Saul LaBarbera, who was the supervisor of Skaggs' unit for years, was quite sophisticated in the way he would talk about it. He, said that he walked this line as a supervisor to kind of keep spirits up, and as I say, they kind of had a perverse pride. Nobody was writing in the newspapers about what they were doing, but they still had to believe it was important. But he would say, that kind of impulse in policing can easily lead to corruption as well. You've got to watch it like a hawk. You don't want that sense of working against the establishment to take a darker turn. And he was very sensitive to that idea that he wanted them to be subversive, but you have to be very careful with the idea of subversiveness in policing. In the end, not having caseloads that were too high, not having what I think were really basic, adequate resources in Southeast, like a functioning interrogation room, hurt them and made it harder to solve their cases. And they had for a while, it's one of those old stations. I actually think those old stations are better than the new ones in some ways, but they had a classroom portable because they didn't have quite enough room and they needed extra office space. And for a while, the only room they had to interrogate people was over in this office portable. And you'd see them at their desk like, okay, what is the defense going to do with this? You took my defendant out to a trailer behind the police station to question him, you know, outside of anyone else's view. It's going to look terrible when we take this to court. It's just not the optimal way to do this.
Why are there so few convictions?
Well, it's very interesting, and what I would really love to know if I had the luxury of a 30-year thought experiment is to know how much it could be changed. I mean, Getoside argues, and I think the Tonelli case argues, that it just takes a little more sometimes, and you can solve more of them. The defense attorney at the end of the book says if they were all investigated like this, we wouldn't have unsolved cases. I think there's other indications of that.
There was a lot of investigation of that because the kid that was killed was the son of a policeman.
Yes, though in fairness, Skaggs had solved nearly all of his cases, even when they weren't the son of a policeman. But when, for example, in South Bureau, they had enough resources for cold case units and they could pick up some of those old cases that had been left unsolved, those units tend to have fairly high solve rates, suggesting that actually when somebody does go back and just put a little more time in, that they are solvable. At the same time, that 40-50% solve rate that I cite in the book is not an LAPD thing. I think you see it everywhere. When I did the homicide report, it was every agency in the county. It was amazing how consistent it was. It was almost like it was a floor that everybody hit. And so I don't actually know if there's something more deeply structural about that, if you just can never push yourself over that 40% line. But I suspect that you can, and the cold cases were one of the things that convinced me that you could.
Is it just a question of focus and the deployment of resources? If, in fact, the police could solve and did solve more murders and make people accountable, would things change?
I mean, it's, as I say in the book, a circumstantial case because this stuff is so complex. What you see in Europe is that a lot of those countries, I mean, normal is 90%. And I think that if you would push it up into the 80s, that it really would. And the reason it would is because, it's a material fact. It changes the conditions on the ground. It changes the facts on the ground. And it's simple economics. You know, one of the things that doing this work did to me was it kind of it stripped the idea of anything mystic about violence. Violence is an asset. Violence can be looked at economically, and the price of violence really does seem to matter in terms of the level of violence. If you make violence very, very expensive, very high risk, you know, if you're looking at having it done your way or controlling that little retail drug market or whatever it is, and your chance of getting caught is, you know, 9 out of 10, that's going to be a very different set of decisions than if your chance of being caught is 3 out of 10. So I think it would make a difference. The idea, one of the lines I love in the book is when the lieutenant is looking around, he says, well, who can solve cases in South Bureau? And he's told by several of his fellow management types, well, Skaggs can solve cases, but he's very expensive, meaning that he will use every overtime hour and he'll find reason to file more and more overtime. And it really shows, and I think it's not just in the police department, that is a management thought across the board. How much is this guy going to cost? There is a school of thought in the history of law enforcement that our system has always been on the cheap side, which I know is the opposite of what people think about this bloated criminal justice system, but of course, communal justice, frontier justice, rough justice is really part of the American tradition. We used to call it California law out here, right? You'd hang people. And one of the justifications given for that in the early days of Los Angeles was that it was really a much more economically efficient, cheap way to do law enforcement, was just to lynch the horse thieves than to have trials. And there's that tradition of cheapness, I think, comes down to the present day. What a lot of possession enforcement, a lot of status offenses, that's the probation and parole searches, it's cheap. It's low-hanging fruit. It's cheap and easy. And what I'm talking about is very, very expensive law enforcement. John Skeggs is expensive. Going back to the same witness four times is expensive. Taking care of your witness once she's entered the system and making sure nothing, it's all expensive. And that's not really in our law enforcement tradition. We've done this quality of life stuff and rounding people up stuff, and that's a lot cheaper.
You mentioned that detectives work with an understanding that the media aren't paying a lot of attention to them. You and I are both media people. You've obviously paid a lot of attention to this, but why is it that we don't hear more about this, and what would be the impact if we did?
Well, I think people know. I mean, I don't think that anything that I say in the book is a secret to anybody. It's very hard to cover it. It's very hard to cover each case, not just because they sound alike and they don't really rise to the level of a news story. They're actually very practically difficult to cover when victims' families are begging you not to use their name in the paper because they're scared of reprisals, or people are, you and I talked about this earlier, you sometimes have to say, don't tell me who did it, because people, you almost become part of that public conversation on the street, and that can be very difficult ethically. So there's tremendous complexity in being a journalist, a daily journalist on the story, but part of the point in Get Aside is we don't have the vocabulary. And this is something that's driven me crazy for years, trying to look up the research that I wanted to. I call it a homicide problem, because to me that's what it is, too many homicides. And I particularly call it a black homicide problem, because I think you can argue for that when you have one group whose rates are, 5 to 8 times white rates for the last probably 80 years or more. Elsewhere, it's called youth violence, or it's called a gang problem, which I think ends up in a terrible mess in terms of what you're going to put your money into. You tend to, violence prevention was a hot term for a long time. Well, look at these violence prevention programs over and over again. It's not all of them, but elder abuse, child abuse, domestic violence, youth violence, and finally they did start pushing that up to about 24, although it started in the teenage years. It's not that there's anything wrong with that. It's not that those aren't serious problems. But the fact of the matter is, if you are focused on homicide, it is adult men. It takes off when they stop being youth. The line goes whoop at 21, 22, and then it stays high all the way through the 30s. So and so you'd have these, even this Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention, these injury programs, you'd have all these categories, and none of them were adult black men fighting each other where most of the deaths were racking up. They would all be these other categories. So you have to name it the right thing, and you have to talk about it the right way. And I also think our insistence that this is a social or cultural or family problem has made it hard to sort of stand back and find some traction of what we as journalists should be covering, what scholars should be studying, etc.
How do African American readers of your book respond?
Very, very mixed. Very, very mixed. I get some angry responses, and I get some incredibly supportive responses. That's the black people are not a monolith. And in fact, it's the nature of these low-income enclaves that I think that conflict is pushed down into them. These are very, very divided places. Even the homicides themselves point to that. What could be a greater conflict with another human being than if a homicide has occurred? And a lot of homicides have occurred in these neighborhoods. So there is no community. There's very different points of view. I have had, of course, powerful and ardent support from family members of homicide victims They tend to really want this story to be told. They want it to be on the news. They want it to be out there. They want people outside their communities to be talking about it. But not all their neighbors necessarily feel the same way.
I could do this all night, but we have promised that you and the audience can ask questions, and I hope that many of you will want to do that. Go ahead. Whoops. And do make it a question rather than a statement.
Absolutely. You make a big point in the book, which I think, you know, much to say about how brave a book it is, doing the research and the rest of it, but it seems to me the bravest thing about the book is your advocacy of what I think you called responsive policing rather than preventive policing. I wonder if you could talk about the way you came to that position. Is this something you brought into the project, or is it something that you learned from your work on the project?
You know, I don't know where I came up with that one. I mean, I had lots and lots of conversations, particularly people high up in policing, where they would say to me, I would say, well, what about these detective problems? And they'd say, but that's just reactive. And by the way, totally well-intentioned, right? They're trying to figure out ways. And I would think about that word reactive, you know, as writers, that word proactive always did seem like a very, very strange word. And just the seductiveness of proactive compared to what I was seeing. I think, you know, what really, and it sounds a little bit off, but what really started me thinking about it was looking at the South in the early part of the 20th century and seeing how crucial that is. There can be all kinds of crime, but violence is different. Violence is power. Whoever is controlling violence and whoever is affording impunity for violence is where the actual political control is in a society. That is the locus of political control. And you can't say that about burglary or vandalism or things like that unless they're part of a message-sending ensemble. Violence actually is the power of the state. And if it's happening outside the state, then that's where the state is really dwelling, whether it officially is that or not. And so when I started to think about that and think about what I was seeing, the intimidation, the way informal organizations are bolstered by them, it seemed to me absolutely a political force, and it seemed to fit that idea of the monopoly on violence being the crucial capture of a legitimate system. And so all of that, it made me think about, made me turn to that idea of impunity for violence being really the corrosive thing that will undercut everything else you're doing if you're trying to create a legal system.
Over here. Oh, there we are.
Hi. Thank you for your work. I have a question about a connection, or if you think there is a connection between neighborhoods where there is a high homicide rate and levels of police brutality.
You know, I'm not really an expert on police brutality, but you did used to see, certainly with shootings, that it followed the homicide curve. And until fairly recently, when it's diverged somewhat, and this suggestion being that it was points on a continuum, that in these very intense environments where everything else was happening, that police were one of the players and that the conflict was affecting them too. Again, that's changed somewhat. We've seen crime go down very little. I think 2013 did see a rise in police shootings. You know, I think in the contemporary situation, it's complicated. One of the things that I heard a lot from people is, I want to move my son out of Watts because I'm afraid he'll get killed here, but my sister lives out in Rialto or in Riverside County, and I'm more scared of the cops there than I am of the LAPD. Even though I hate the LAPD, at least they're, you know, the devil I know, and they know me, and they know they work in this neighborhood. So it's, you know, even in that statement, you can see the layers and layers of conflict. the brutality thing is very interesting. In I think 1977 or 78, the LAPD made a very fine adjustment to its shooting policy having to do with fleeing felons. And I'm trying to remember, I think it was actually kind of a nuanced change about what they had to have done bodily harm or something. And within a year, the number of police shootings fell by half right after that policy change. It's very interesting. This is not an era that we think of as enlightened policing, but it tells you a couple things that are important. One, the reason this is such a sore point is, boy, a heck of a lot of people used to get shot by the police. It's astounding to look in those numbers. There are some numbers of police shootings in urban areas of the South from the mid-century that rival what homicide rates were. Just the police shootings alone later in the century. A heck of a lot of people were shot. I found clips in the LA Times who were fleeing felons who weren't armed, who were being shot, and sometimes they were a few blocks away from where the crime, like the police had just driven around and found someone running and shot them, you know. But at the same time, it also tells you that the police are responsive to training and policy. The idea that it would fall that much in a single year. So, I think there's lots of interesting questions to pursue about that.
Let's go over here.
I wonder if you would comment and give some insight on two factors that I think play into the situation, which is the ready availability of handguns and the criminalization of certain drugs, which we see now being decriminalized in other places around the country.
Yeah, well, and those actually can kind of cross each other because, if you take the basic tenet that black markets fuel homicide, which I think black markets fuel homicide, you can create a black market for guns by restricting guns, and the assumption would be that would create some homicides. You know, the issue of controlling guns almost never comes up in the police divisions where I've worked, and that's because, as I say in my book, nobody has ever seen a legal gun in these cases. I think I asked John Skaggs, when have you ever seen one? It's not the guns they're seeing. Guns are made of steel, I guess. They last a long time, decades and decades and decades, and there are millions of guns, and so there's this sea of illegal firearms being passed around, and there's nothing that legislation does that touches them. They're already illegal guns. I find the gun issue a little frustrating for a lot of reasons. One is that if you look back in history, you see similar death rates from homicide at different points. There's a study I cite in the book from Philadelphia in the 40s, where it's the same death rate as later in the century, but it's mostly stabbings. So they're getting the same death rate with knives that later would be achieved with guns. So that tells you that it's not, in some way, it's not a first cause. And I guess the other thing I would say is that we have, nearly a third of our homicide victims are stabbing victims and bludgeoning victims, and I just never hear anybody talk about them at all, and they are just as dead, and it's just as horrific. And this is one of the reasons why I talk about vocabulary and definitions. If you call this a gun violence problem, you're missing, a couple thousand people a year, young men in these neighborhoods who leave just as big a crater behind, and so.
Okay.
Yes, what do you think the legalization of drugs, what would the impact be on this one? Yeah, mentioned, but you didn't get to it.
You know, it's that one is very interesting. I do think that, one of the things I saw, even in my short term here, and I get just a little piece of history in the 10 or so years I've done it, was the change in the way the drug trade is carried out on the street, where when I first started, it was the tail end of the 90s and the early 2000s, there's still territories and a lot of, somebody lined up having an outdoor drug market. Cell phones radically changed all of that and I think really brought down the homicide rate, just the fact that people were meeting their buyers instead of needing to set up a market that was so public. At the same time, it's astounding how few homicides are straight drug deal homicides, despite what people think. The CDC did a study a few years ago, actually of LA County, and came up with 5% of the homicides were actually where drugs were directly involved. You know, sometimes it's, you know, we've had this business going, and you were an informant, or you stole something, but actually about a debt, for example, or about stolen drugs. That fits with my experience. Most of the homicides in Watts were not drug homicides, and when they were, it tended to be out of the fighting mix. It tended to be older guys who maybe were active gang members when they were young, but not particularly affiliated anymore, maybe in their 40s. Maybe they were just that layer. There's some kind of retail break where the drugs are coming from Mexicans, and Mexicans are controlling the trade almost down to the street, but right at that juncture, there's a stash house or something. So it would tend to be in that part of it, but the furious 18 to 24 fighting and retaliation violence would seem a little separate from that. So,
over here.
Well, thank you very much for an interesting discussion. At one point, you said that in Europe, one would see solve rates, very high solve rates, 80, 90%. But I'm wondering, especially in the change in the last few years with the immigration problem in Europe and the immigration ghettos, if you will, if you might extrapolate the kinds of findings you're having here with the walled city as being something we're seeing a rise of in Europe.
Yeah, and I think they have seen that, wherever you see that kind of legitimacy problem, that problem where, you know, somebody is not feeling they're sort of fully central to the democratic process, they really... they do see the same problems with clearance rates. I don't know a lot about it. I've seen some numbers that suggest that, Caribbeans in London, actually the solve rates are similar to what you see in South LA. I met a detective from London who was visiting while I was embedded, and she just blew me away. She said, you know, it's, you know, people of immigrant extraction, it's primarily men. It's strange how petty it is. It's over insults. It's over women. We had a homicide recently. She said it was involved a dance hall and a broken gold chain. Somebody had grabbed a gold chain. Well, of course, the broken gold chain is a super familiar trope from the streets of Los Angeles. That's a highly symbolic act if you break someone's gold chain. And the idea that even that symbolism of the informal sort of street system would have migrated or been reinvented, who knows, across the ocean was really astounding to me. So,
up on the top. Okay.
Do you feel that the impunity factor is the strongest driving force as opposed to the drugs and or guns, the availability of guns and the black market in drugs, that the impunity is superimposed on top of that?
I think that, I guess, I don't think any of that. I think this is endlessly, endlessly complex. And one of the things I'm trying to do in Ghetto Side is sort of bring forth elements that I don't think we're talking about enough. I do think that if you have high levels of impunity, it's just prima facie a problem. That's just a terrible thing when murders are going unsolved, and it's bound to have effects. I think that, white Americans have higher homicide rates than it's not... They're not as high as black homicide rates, but all over America we live with, I think, higher homicide rates because I think our systems are generally weak in this way. And actually, Warren, maybe you can relate to this. When homicide rates were very high across groups and things were really out of control, the 70s, it really is on paper, it's amazing to look at that. White homicide rates were quite high in the 70s too. I think we could all... who went through that era can remember that sure. It just felt rougher, that America just felt a lot rougher. Our cities felt a lot more dangerous and a lot rougher. It affected a lot of aspects of life. It affects everybody, and so it's a problem. I don't think that you would see the outsized rates that you do in Black Americans if it wasn't for, like I say, segregation, I think, is the huge one, and so many people just being, you know, completely off the books, never working, dependent entirely on some kind of hustle. There's just been a whole class of people, particularly if they've served time in prison and it's very difficult to get jobs and so forth, that end up going from hustle to hustle. Sometimes admirably, I have to say, if you know this world, you see people come up with really good hustles where they can survive and they're not hurting anybody, and sometimes not so much. When you need to eat and you're, you know, we have a general relief check that's $212 a month or something like that, and you're desperate, of course, you're going to not only commit crimes, but you're going to need an informal network of people. You're going to need to trade on the black market. You're going to need to have the kind of connections that, as I say in my book, white, affluent Americans who are living in suburbs barely know their neighbors, let alone are depending for their next meal on what their neighbor is going to do. So that kind of intimate networked connections is going to create a violence enclave very easily.
Thank you guys for some wonderful questions. Jill will be available. Jill Iovi.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.